Tuesday is Election Day, but overshadowing any voting next week is the countdown to Election Day 2016, when the ballot will include the candidates seeking to become the 45th President of the United States. So as our nation increasingly turns its attention to November 8th, 2016, I would like to invite us to reflect on our fifth UU principle: the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. In particular, I would like to explore some of the roots of the partisan divide in our country, using as a guide a book titled The Jefferson Rule: How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible, by David Sahat, Associate Professor of History at Georgia State University. And as we look to history for lessons that might inform our democracy today, one of the biggest takeaways from Sahat's book is a reminder that from the beginning, the founders of this nation were not unified in their vision, in their hopes, and in their dreams for this country. So we should be wary of anyone who tries to conflate the founders all together with claims about, oh, all the founders say this, or all of the founders say that. Because the founders often disagreed profoundly, and many of those tensions remain with us today. But before we plunge fully into the 18th century, allow me to make one more overall point. In general, I invite you to consider that our UU heritage should make us cautious of claims that we should do or believe something simply because the founders said so. To unquestioningly follow authority figures, whether they are religious or political authorities, abdicates our responsibility to use our reason to look at our own experience and the experience of those around us. As one of our hymns says, ours is a freedom that reveres the past but trusts the dawning future more. In contrast, however, I was raised in a theologically and politically conservative context that taught me to believe in a perfect past from which we have fallen. Perhaps some of you were told similar stories. In my childhood, this perfect past was embodied theologically in the Garden of Eden, which was understood to have existed geographically about 6,000 years ago or so. And this perfect past was embodied politically in a rose-colored view of our founding fathers and of our founding documents. I was taught that we should struggle to return ourselves and our society to be in alignment with that allegedly perfect past, but that irrespective of what happens, God would guarantee a perfect future for the righteous. Today, I've come to a different understanding of the past and of the present and of the future. Accordingly, for myself, at least three of my personal maxims are: one, there never was a perfect past. So there is no perfect past that we could return to. But still, there are stories of exemplary people and exemplary communities in the past, such as our founders in some ways, that can inspire us today. Second, there is no single perfect way for every community to be in this present or in any other present moment, which means that I am a pluralist. I believe that there is more than one legitimate way of being in the world. That does not mean that I am a relativist. I do not believe that every possibility is equally worthy of our time and attention. And third, there is no guarantee of a perfect future. But we can nevertheless choose love, choose compassion, and choose forgiveness as a way of doing what we can, that which is in our control, to increase our chances of creating a more hopeful future. So even as we learn from history, we must also consider new possibilities that were not even conceivable when our nation was founded more than two centuries ago. Turning then historically to the founders of our country, much of what united them was not rallying together for a shared philosophy of government. What united them was rallying against Great Britain. And when that common enemy was defeated, there was infighting about how best to unite the original 13 colonies into the United States of America. And when General Washington became President Washington, he found that the cabinet members within his administration were significantly harder to keep unified than his soldiers had been when he was Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. Consider just three cases. First, Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary. He was a vocal advocate of, we need a strong national government. Conversely, Thomas Jefferson, our first Secretary of State, was equally vocal for a weak national government. Moreover, Jefferson, that famed writer of the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, did not support the writing of the U.S. Constitution, would have preferred instead to keep the Articles of Confederation and amend them, and he was in Paris during the entire Constitutional Convention. Jefferson wasn't the only constitutional detractor among the founders. Edmund Randolph, one of the three people who stayed through the entire constitutional conversation and then declined to sign the final document, he became Attorney General, the chief law enforcement officer of the new government. So, you don't really agree with the Constitution and don't want to sign it, we'll make you Attorney General. You know, that's the sort of decisions that we can get behind. So suffice it to say that Washington predicted that his new administration would have, quote, tranquil deliberations and voluntary consent. But it turned out that the leaders of the new government were characterized by a much more combative reality. And in ways that parallel today's legal arguments about how the Constitution should be interpreted, major controversies arose from the beginning. For instance, on the question of whether forming a national bank, whether or not that was constitutional, Jefferson and Madison and other founders who favored a smaller, weaker national government emphasized the states' rights perspective of the 10th Amendment. They said, it says right there in the Constitution that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. This strict constructionist approach to the Constitution sees the Constitution as like the Magna Carta, primarily a restraint on power that was a charter for liberty. But on the other side, Hamilton and his supporters of a strong national government looked at that same Constitution and emphasized the Necessary and Proper Clause of Article 1, Section 8, which gave Congress the implicit right to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. This broad constructionist approach holds that if Congress has the express power to do one thing, like collect taxes, it has the implied power to do other things, such as chartering a national bank, which are the means of exercising the express power. Now, both perspectives are rational interpretations of the exact same document, but they just reach widely divergent conclusions. Philosopher Alistair MacIntyre famously wrote a book called Whose Justice, Which Rationality? Because that makes all the difference in looking at the same text and coming to completely different conclusions. And for at least this first skirmish, Washington ultimately sided with Hamilton, and broad constructionism won the day. But these ideological battles continue into our present moment. Also fascinatingly, even though Hamilton, that early champion of a strong national government and of a broad constructionist interpretation of the Constitution, even though he was killed in a duel with Aaron Burr, who was Thomas Jefferson's vice president, Jefferson ironically ended up using Hamilton's arguments for why we should have a strong national government and why we should have broad constructionism when the decision arose of whether or not the Louisiana Purchase was legal. So to justify that interpretation of treaty rights in the Constitution, Jefferson took a play out of Hamilton's playbook, proving that he was ultimately willing to be a pragmatist, not an ideologue. There's a lot more to be said about how the founders didn't write a perfect document, such as the fact that to date we've amended it 27 times, generally improving it most of those times. Remember, for example, that Jefferson was the second vice president of this nation, not because he was John Adams's running mate, but because the Constitution, prior to the 12th Amendment in 1804, granted the vice presidency to the runner-up. So imagine the equivalent today if Obama's VP had been Romney and or McCain during his respective terms in office, or if Bush's VP had been Gore and then Kerry. That is the equivalent to Jefferson being Adams' vice president. But for now, in this brief journey through the history of our country's democratic process, allow me to skip ahead to the Civil War, which less than a century after this country's founding created perhaps our greatest constitutional crisis, born out of the ongoing power struggle reflected in that strict constructionist, small government, states' rights approach to the Constitution versus a broad constructionist, strong government, federalist approach. As our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, said in his Gettysburg Address, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. But looking back on the carnage that was the Civil War, David Sahat challenges us to see that in a fundamental sense, the union that the founders had envisioned had failed. Constitutions are supposed to keep citizens from killing each other. In a constitutional democracy, citizens are supposed to solve their disagreements by voting. But Americans killed each other on a horrific scale in the Civil War. And in the aftermath of almost 2% of the U.S. population killing one another, the Constitution had to change. So the 13th Amendment of 1865 abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment of 1868 nationalized citizenship and made the federal government into the guarantor of individual American rights. And the 15th Amendment of 1870 gave all men the right to vote. The total effect of those three amendments was a revolution of national purposes and of constitutional design. It was not simply a restoration of the original vision of the founders. Accordingly, it's significant to note an increasingly realistic view of the founders that came in the ensuing decades after the Civil War that contrasts sharply with the much more idealized view of the founders among many groups today here in the 21st century. For example, our 18th president, Ulysses Grant, who had been the commanding general of the Union Army during the Civil War, said regarding the founders, "We could not and should not be rigidly bound by the rules laid down in circumstances so different. It is preposterous to suppose that the people of one generation can lay down the best and only form of government for all who are to come after them." Grant recognized that when the founders had first created the Constitution, they lived in an age of sails and horses. But Grant's generation used steam, the telegraph, the iron ship, and 1,000 other things that the founders could never have imagined. We today are heir to a globalized world of space travel, smartphones, and the internet. In a similar vein, our 26th president, Teddy Roosevelt, said, "Our forefathers faced certain perils which we have outgrown. We now face other perils, the very existence of which was impossible that they should foresee. The problems are new, the tasks before us different from the tasks set before our fathers." Such distancing views are not how we have heard the founders usually talked about in recent decades. This trajectory of disidentifying with the founders was massively reversed with the Reagan Revolution. In the 1980s, Reagan told the story of our nation's founding as a mythologically perfect past to which we needed to return. As the Reagan campaign told the story, all the founders had supported a strict constructionist, small government, states' rights view, when that was really just one among many positions held by various founders. And that view was represented most famously by Thomas Jefferson. But as we have discussed, Thomas Jefferson was neither at the Constitutional Convention, nor did he want the Constitution in the first place. The founders were not of one mind and had profound ideological disagreements about the nature of government. And there have always been significant supporters among our nation's leaders, both then and now, both in the strict constructionist and the broad constructionist camps of constitutional interpretation. And as we consider this sweep of our nation's history, it's important to be honest that it is not a coincidence that this full-throated resurgence of Jeffersonian, small government, states' rights, this neo-Confederate view of U.S. history, it is not a coincidence that it arose in the late 1970s, about a decade after the Civil Rights, precisely as a reactionary protest against the victories won for equality at the federal level in the 1960s. Related to the shift we've been discussing in U.S. Culture in reaction to the civil rights movement in the 1960s, we saw with the elevation of William Rehnquist to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he served from 86 to 2005, we saw a shift away from the jurisprudence that had allowed the creation of the social safety net policies of the New Deal in the 1930s. And we began to see a shift toward a new form of strict constructionism toward the Constitution, known as constitutional originalism, which sought to find the founder's original meaning and to argue that only the founder's original meaning was the legitimate interpretation. But as we have seen, that quest is arguably impossible because the founders did not agree amongst themselves about how to read that document. In the words of Justice William Brennan, originalism is arrogance masked as humility. Arrogance masked as humility. It pretends to be neutrally interpreting the founders, but the end result is almost always an advancement of the particular justice's own biases and preferences. In the full sweep of U.S. history, we can see that we are witnessing the same interpretive battles today that had been at play since the time when Secretary of State Jefferson and Treasury Secretary Hamilton were each trying to convince President Washington that their respective position was the one true right interpretation of the Constitution. And then, as now, it is unclear what the future will bring. There is no guarantee. To give just one final example of history's difficult to predict twists and turns, in 1987, President Reagan's nominee to the Supreme Court was Robert Bork, who was ideologically to the right even of Justice Antonin Scalia. But when Bork's nomination was defeated in the Senate, the defeat of that nomination was led by none other than current Vice President Joe Biden. It's interesting how all these things play out. Reagan instead nominated the moderate conservative Anthony Kennedy. So it turns out that a Reagan nominee to the Supreme Court wrote the majority opinion on major cases advancing social justice for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, such as 2003's Lawrence versus Texas and 2015's Obergefell versus Hodges. Now, Kennedy also wrote the majority opinion on a landmark case that is perhaps doing more than anything else to continue and undergird wealth inequality in our country, and that is 2010's Citizens United decision. So my hope for this morning has been to trace some of the touchstones, reflecting on the roots of our democratic process in order to explore how some of the current branches of our democracy have come to be shaped as they are. And for now, near the beginning of a presidential election year, I will conclude with a quote from the author and environmental activist Terry Tempest Williams. She's also, incidentally, Mitt Romney's cousin once removed. Her grandmother and Governor Romney's father were cousins. In an essay titled Engagement, Tempest writes, "The human heart is the first home of democracy. It is in our heart where we embrace our questions. Can we be equitable? Can we be generous? Can we listen with our whole beings and not only our minds? Can we offer our attention to others and not merely our opinions? And do we have enough resolve in our hearts to act courageously, relentlessly, without giving up in our determined pursuit of a living democracy?" Because democracy depends on engagement, a firsthand accounting of what one sees, what one feels, what one thinks. So in the coming days and weeks and months, let us question, Let us stand, let us speak, and let us act.